Chapter 3. I watched as McElfrish set the sack of gold coins on the scale in the workroom of St. Dunstan's, and I saw it come in at just over 50 pounds. No wonder lugging it around had been such a chore.
Isn't that a lovely sight?
Owen grinned as he looked at the final readout of the digital scale. The short, dark-haired man pulled out his phone and did some calculations, clicked his tongue, and then held it out so I could see the sum.
$960,000.
I read the calculator app out loud, and my voice caught a little.
Holy fucking shit.
Just shy of a million, and I still had a bunch of silver and copper coins, as well as some jewelry and loose jewels sitting in my safe at home.
I'll double-check the current market rates,
Owen said as he looked at his phone again with a broad smile.
Just so you know, I'm not trying to cheat you. But based on our last transaction and the cut I take to transfer it to crypto and keep this all out of the IRS's vision, that should be about right.
Jesus, I breathed. I knew he was taking his cut, but it still seemed like a stupid amount of money, because it was.
Mary and Joseph?
McElfrish chuckled.
Let's go to the front, and I'll write you up a receipt.
I followed Owen to the front of the store, where Ricky was still posted up near the front door, watching something on his phone and chuckling from time to time. Owen went behind one of the many counters and started fishing around for a receipt pad, so I stepped up to the counter while I waited and looked down at the shining rings and necklaces on display under the glass. There was a big-ass diamond solitaire right in the middle of all of the other audacious jewelry, and it occurred to me that I was a married man now, semi-officially, given I had a forged marriage certificate. Bringing a ring home for Ibsith would be a fun surprise.
Here we are.
Owen puffed as he straightened from searching under the counter, with a receipt pad in hand.
Now, let's see how many zeros we can fit on the little pad.
I know it's after work hours, I said and gestured at the glass counter. But how much is that engagement ring in the middle there?
Bringing the missus home a little something?
McElfrish winked.
Let's take a look, then.
The short Irishman pulled a ring of keys from under his well-tailored blazer and took a moment to find the one that unlocked the case. Then Owen gingerly reached into the carefully laid-out display and deftly picked up the ring without disturbing any of the other jewels on their velvet pillows.
Says it's 6,500?
The dark-haired man continued as he read the little tag connected to the ring's band.
But of course, you'll get the friends and family discount, and I'm assuming you'll want a couple of wedding bands to go with it.
That's actually a pretty good idea, I nodded. And maybe a necklace for Emrila? A ring wouldn't be very practical for the Zinkari woman, since her favored weapons were her two swords, but I was pretty sure she wasn't above a little personal decoration.
Can't have one getting jealous of the other,
Owen grinned.
Let's take a look around and see what we can find.
After about 20 minutes of looking around at various display cases, I'd found a matching pair of wedding bands and a gold necklace with a charm in the shape of an A, set with dark rubies.
With the discount, we'll call that all an even 10 grand,
Owen said as he wrote up a second receipt.
Do you want me to subtract that from what I'm giving you for the gold?
Sure, I replied, as I watched him write out the second receipt. It seemed weird he wasn't ringing it up on a POS system. I figured a business like this would want to keep careful track of its stock and earnings. I knew Owen wrote me a receipt more for our own personal records, and so Meyer could do his magic with the minimum electronic trail. But as I looked around, I noticed there weren't computers on any of the counters, just old-fashioned registers at a couple of them. From where I was standing, I could also see at least 4 high-end security cameras, so it wasn't like the older man was completely averse to technology. But then, Meyer had hinted how McElfrish was a shady character when he'd recommended the Irishman. As long as he was willing to buy my gold at a fair rate, I guess it was better not to ask too many questions.
All right.
Owen gave me a friendly smile as he set 3 small velvet boxes into a nice bag with St. Dunstan's logo printed on the front in gold.
That brings us around to a modest business offer I have for you.
Oh, right, I said, and now I felt a little uncomfortable. What is it? What could a man like him possibly want from a man like me?
Well, there's not too many details at the moment,
Owen replied as he scratched his chin.
But I've been thinking of expanding. Might bring in a few investors. The buy-in would be about 1 million, but you'd get a stake in any future earnings. Essentially, you'd be making money for doing almost nothing.
Okay, I said in a neutral tone. I'll think about it. Let me know when there are some more details.
Oh, of course,
McElfers said as he pulled the two receipts off the pad and handed them to me.
You enjoy the rest of your evening now, Eddie.
You too, Owen, I replied with a smile as I took the receipts. Then I turned to go, and Ricky was already standing up and opening the door for me. The burly man and I nodded at each other as I walked through the door and headed out into the balmy summer night. And on the way to the truck, I thought about Owen's offer. It wasn't much, really, more the idea of a potential offer. And $1 million was a ton of money. Sure, I had a pile of gold and jewelry still sitting in my safe, but it was a lot smaller than it was this morning, and I had just bought the Jeep and made an offer on the Miller's home. On one hand, investing the money and letting it build up into something more was very appealing. I was a rich man, and I could end up being a whole lot richer. But on the other hand, I didn't know Owen that well, and I had no idea what all went on behind the scenes. Obviously, anyone who could get a hold of fake identity papers had some criminal connections. I would have to get a hold of Travis anyway to let him know about the sale of the gold coins, so I would just ask my lawyer's advice then. I got in the truck and started to drive back to the theater to get the ladies. When I pulled into the theater parking lot, I saw I was there before the movie let out, so I pulled out my phone and texted Travis Meyer. It was getting late, so I assumed I wouldn't hear back until morning, but that was fine. Hey, just saw Owen. Have another deposit for you. I'll be free all day tomorrow if you need to call me. I was about to put away my phone when it started to ring. I looked at the screen and saw it was Travis, so I answered it. Hello? I said into the phone.
Mr. Who?
Travis's dry voice came across the line.
Having a good evening.
Yeah, I'm having a great evening, I snorted. I just sold a bunch more gold coins for almost $1 million.
That's fantastic,
Meyer replied in an uninflected tone.
I'll get to work as soon as I get the transfer through from Mr. McElfresh. Has there been any progress on the house you wanted to buy?
Wow, Travis never missed a beat. I could only imagine all of the information the CPA kept in his head at any given time, and just how many clients he might have. I made an offer earlier today, I answered. I told him I'd pay $200,000 and take care of closing costs.
That's a pretty good price for a 3-bedroom in Westhurst.
Meyer's voice sounded very serious.
Given the current market, but if we're covering closing costs, we could probably talk them down to $170,000.
I'm sure you could, I said, but I'm not really hurting for the money, and it's still a lot less than I'd pay if you went through a realtor.
That's very true,
the lawyer agreed.
Either way, that money's ready and set aside when you need it.
Thanks, Meyer, I replied as I saw the crowd from the movie start to filter out into the parking lot.
No need to thank me,
Travis said placidly.
It's what you pay me for.
I said goodbye, got off the phone, and started the truck. Then I drove around to the front where Ibsith and Amrila were waiting, pulled up to the curb, and went around to the passenger side to open the door for the women. How was the movie? I asked as I helped them into the truck.
It was lovely.
Ibsith grinned and she climbed into the middle seat.
The hero nearly died trying to save the woman he loved. And he saved the city, too.
There was not enough blood.
Amrila snorted.
How could a man that size punch a villain in the face so many times and merely bloody his nose? The explosions were quite a spectacle, though.
I'm glad you both liked it. I chuckled, and then I closed the door once the ladies were settled in. I went around to the driver's side, got in, and pulled away from the curb. But I stopped in an empty parking space.
Are we not going home?
Amrila asked in a confused tone. In a minute, but first, I got something for both of you while I was selling the gold. I replied, and I reached down and grabbed the bag from St. Dunstan's. Then I handed each woman a velvet box and sat back to watch their faces. Ibsith opened her box to reveal the big solitaire in a tasteful setting and the wedding band.
Oh, Eddie,
the blue-skinned woman breathed.
I have never seen a diamond that shines like this, and the band is so beautiful, thank you.
Ibsith threw her arms around me and kissed me deeply, and as I came up for air, I could hear Amrila gasp as she finally figured out how to open the box.
It's so delicate,
the horned woman said,
The work is so fine, it looks like fairies forged it. Is the A for my name?
Yeah. I grinned when I saw the uncharacteristically shocked look on the Zinkari woman's face. Do you like it?
I adore it.
Amrila purred as her dark eyes met mine.
I don't even know what to say, Eddie. This is so nice.
The rings are a human tradition. I explained to Ibsith, that's what you give someone when you marry them. I would have gotten you a ring too, Amrila, but legally, I can only be officially married to one of you. Plus, I figured with your swords, a ring with a big gemstone might just get in the way.
I do not need a ring to prove to anyone that I am your wife.
Amrila scoffed as she pulled her new necklace from the box and held it up to the light.
As long as you say I am, then I will be yours alone. And my sweet sister?
Ibsith added as she hugged the red-skinned woman tightly.
Yes, yes.
Amrila said as she patted the elven woman's arm.
Now, help me figure out this clasp, sister.
It took a few minutes, but between the two of them, they managed to get the tiny clasp open and the necklace around Amrila's neck. The little A fell at just the right space above the horned woman's cleavage, which was an added bonus. The Zinkari pulled down the visor and flipped down the vanity mirror so she could admire the necklace for a moment, and I had to admit the gold looked beautiful against her red skin. Then Ibsith pulled the rings from her box, and I showed her which finger to wear them on. The two rings fit perfectly, and the elf held out her hand to see how they looked on her.
Oh, they are perfect.
My elven wife sighed. Now they are, I said as I slipped on my wedding ring. You're both the most amazing women I've ever met. I'm the luckiest man alive. Oh, and there's one more thing. I grabbed the manila envelope Owen had given me and rummaged around the various papers for the IDs. There's one for each of you, I continued as I handed the ladies their ID cards. Keep them in your wallets and your purses, and make sure you have them with you whenever you're out.
Ibsith Hill,
the white-haired woman read in a proud tone, and I knew she was as proud of being able to read it as much as she was proud to bear my name.
Amrila Sido...
The red-skinned woman tried to get her mouth around the sounds but was having trouble. I leaned over and looked at the ID in my half-demon wife's hands. Sidorov, I read out loud. Huh, I guess according to the paperwork for both of you, you're Ukrainian.
Why don't I have the same last name?
Amrila asked.
I like Hill.
Well, I hesitated for a second, but I knew Amrila wasn't that upset about the harem aspect of our relationship. The government of my world doesn't want a man having multiple wives, so none of our legal paperwork can say we were both married.
Oh.
The red-skinned beauty chuckled.
I get to be your secret wife. I love it. Let's go home, my king.
Ibsith said as she laid her head on my shoulder. As my queen's wish, I chuckled, and then I pulled out of the theater parking lot for Westhurst. The next morning, I happened to be up before my wives, so I decided to start the coffee and whip up some omelets for them both while they slept in a little. As I was cutting up some red onions, red and green bell peppers to add to the omelets, along with some chopped ham we had in the fridge, I heard a loud honk outside, so I wiped my hands on a kitchen towel I had over my shoulder and went to the living room window to peek out of the heavy curtains. Outside, my big, beautiful, burnt-orange Rubicon was being lowered off a big flatbed truck that was going to have a hell of a time getting out of the cul-de-sac. Fuck yeah. I slipped on a pair of clogs next to the door, and I picked up my wallet from the small table where I threw my keys whenever I was home, and put it in the pocket of my pajama pants. Then I stepped outside to greet the two men in polos with the logo of the Jeep dealership on them.
Mr. Hill?
A sun-battered man in his 30s asked as he came up to me. The gentleman had a clipboard in his hand with some paperwork on it, and he stood supervising the offloading of my new Jeep. His face had a weathered look of someone who'd worked outside his whole life, and he looked all business. That's me. I smiled as I put my hands on my hips, admired my new vehicle, and took my wallet out of my pocket. Here's my ID.
Thank you.
The leathery man replied as he looked over my ID and checked it against the information on his clipboard. The tanned man had some paperwork for me to sign, and soon enough I had the keys in my hand. As the sun-worn man and his co-worker got back into the flatbed truck and ponderously maneuvered around and out of the cul-de-sac, I walked around my new Jeep and just enjoyed the feeling of having a brand new vehicle for the first time in my life. But the enjoyment didn't last long, since I saw Brock Stanton exit his house dressed in a work polo from the security company he owned. The beefy, bald man started to walk toward his car until he looked up and saw me standing next to the Rubicon. Then, the big man pivoted and started to head toward me with a smile on his face, like the cat that had eaten the canary. What the fuck did he want?
"Hey, Eddie!"
Brock said in a voice that was slightly louder than it needed to be.
"No work today, huh?"
The bull-necked man looked me up and down and took in my t-shirt, plaid pajama pants, and clogs. I had several inches on Brock, but he had at least 30 pounds on me. I could tell it bothered him that he had to look up to talk to me. "I work from home," I reminded Stanton. "Doing graphic design?"
"Well," Brock gave me a slimy smile. "Must be doing pretty well to get this here. Rubicon, huh? These are pretty expensive."
Brock slapped the fender on the new Jeep, and it was all I could do not to punch him right then and there. Guys like Stanton count on the fact we live in a civilized world to get away with their dick-headed behaviors, and I couldn't help but think that if someone just broke down and kicked his ass, it would take him down a peg. "My business is doing great, actually," I replied tightly. "Did you need something, Brock?"
"I'm doing really well, too,"
the beefy man said as he completely ignored my question.
"Thinking about buying the Miller's place as a gift for my son. He's about to graduate from OSU. Did you hear Miller was thinking about selling?"
"This asshole." "Yeah," I nodded and fought everything in me not to ball up my fists. "I heard that."
"I offered David $250,000 last night,"
Brock continued on as if he'd stopped listening to me altogether.
"He said he'd think about it."
Stanton was watching me out of the corner of his eye, and I could tell he was trying to gauge my reaction. Clearly he learned about my offer, since he'd obviously tried to one-up me. David must have mentioned I had made an offer on the house when Brock talked to him the night before, but it was also obvious Brock was trying to needle me into a reaction, and I wasn't going to give him the satisfaction. I shoved down all the annoyance I felt at Brock and put on a big smile. It was a trick I'd learned from my dad. Whenever anyone would try to get a rise out of him, Dad would just kill them with kindness, which often just pissed off or frustrated the other person when they didn't get the response they wanted. "I actually made an offer on David's place, too," I said in an amiable tone. "Looks like I might have to up the ante a little." Something in Stanton's eyes darkened a little when I didn't take the bait.
"I wouldn't get into a bidding war with me, son,"
the burly man said with a plastered-on smile, and he threw a meaningful look at my old trailer.
"I don't think you could afford it. I'm very successful."
"I'm not your son," I said while still grinning back at Brock, "and I like challenges." Brock's eyes narrowed at me, and I could see his big neck turning red as he started to get angry. But I just looked right back at him, cool as a pair of tits on a nude beach in Antarctica. Without another word, Stanton turned and headed back to his white sedan, but he made sure to squeal his tires as he peeled out, as if I was supposed to be impressed or intimidated by his impotent display. I turned and went back into the house to finish making breakfast for the ladies, but when I got into the house, I found Ibsith still in a soft, cotton nightgown that barely covered her round, supple ass, and she was chopping up the rest of the vegetables I'd left on the counter.
"Oh, hell no," I rumbled playfully.
"Nuh-uh, you get yourself a cup of coffee and go chill out on the back porch. It's a fucking beautiful day out. I'll make breakfast today. Thank you."
"If that's what my king wishes."
Ibsith looked up at me with a mock pout on her face, and she batted her big, violet eyes at me as she played along. "I insist," I said, as I put my hands around her waist and pulled her in for a kiss.
"Are you sure you do not want some help?"
The blue-skinned woman hesitated before she turned to get herself some coffee.
"You heard our king,"
Amrila said as she stumbled out of her room, with her strawberry blonde hair still sleep-tousled.
"He banished us to the back porch to enjoy the ghastly sun."
The Zinkari woman grabbed two coffee mugs, poured one for both herself and Ibsith, and then hustled the blue-skinned woman out of the back door as she deftly grabbed her oversized sunglasses off the counter on her way out. I smiled as I went back to work on the omelets, and the magic of my charming wives banished Brock Stanton from my mind. Once I had all three plates ready, I took them out to the back porch, and the three of us sat on our camp chairs to enjoy our little piece of paradise.
"Hey,"
I said around a mouthful of what I'd admit was the world's best omelet. "How about we take the new Jeep out on the back roads and see what it can do?"
Does it do something different than the truck?
Ibsith asked as she delicately cut a bite off of her omelet with the side of her fork and ate it.
Oh my God, Eddie! This is even better than the ones they serve at the diner!
Pretty good, yeah? I grinned. And yeah, the Jeep can handle things our old truck just can't. You know how we have to park the truck at that one gate when we go gigging and walk the rest of the way? Well, with the Jeep, we could drive up almost next to the pond, no problem.
So, it's better over rough ground?
Amrila asked as she took another bite of her food, and then her black eyes rolled back into her head.
Why have you not made these before?
I'll make us omelets more often. I grinned. And we'd have to really try hard to find something that the Jeep couldn't drive over.
Can we drive it over Brock Stanton?
The red-skinned woman snorted. Unfortunately, no, I replied with a sigh. But we can take it out and have some fun. After we'd finished breakfast and taken our plates back into the kitchen, the three of us got dressed and ready for our little adventure. I put on an old pair of jeans and a heather gray t-shirt, and then I pulled on my work boots. Ibsith decided to forego her signature sundresses for a short pair of jean shorts and a little white tank top, and Amrila came out of a room in some high-waisted black shorts and a cropped gray shirt that showed off her firm stomach and toned legs. Once we got out to the Rubicon, the night elf woman opted to sit in the back while Amrila took the passenger seat. The Rubicon started up with a satisfying roar, and I pulled out of the driveway and headed toward the outskirts of town. I drove south, away from Lake Erie, and toward the more rural forested areas. I didn't bother with the GPS, since I figured I'd use it to get back when we were ready to head home. Right then, I just wanted to get lost in the hills and trees. I kinda wished we were a little further south, where the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains started, but I knew there would still be some good, curvy roads that would show me how well the Jeep handled. The backcountry of Ohio was filled with those kinds of dirt roads. You just had to be careful of anyone coming the opposite way, since a lot of them were narrow and didn't have a lot of room to pass. I turned on the radio as I drove us out of town and found a rock station out of Cleveland that I'd listened to all the way through college. Queen started to play, and I turned it up a little.
What is this?
The horned woman next to me asked as she pointed at the speaker. It's a rock band called Queen. I shrugged. This is one of their best-known songs.
They made this music with rocks?
Amrila asked with a raised eyebrow. No, I snorted. They call it that because it makes you want to rock and roll your body to the music. I moved back and forth in my seat to demonstrate, which caused both the ladies to break out in a good-natured laughter.
Well, I like it,
the Zincari woman said as she started to sway in her seat.
This is good rock and rolling music.
Yeah, it is, I laughed. Soon we reached the long, open stretches of back roads that cut through the farming country around Westhurst, and I stepped on the gas. The Jeep jumped, and we were going 90 miles an hour within seconds.
Oh!
Ibsith squealed in the back seat and grabbed the oh shit handle on the door, but Amrila just let out a throaty laugh and kicked back in her seat as I pulled the SUV back to 80 and cruised for a while. Eventually, I found a turnoff for a country road and headed onto a tree-lined road. I took it easy for a while as we passed some houses and cabins with huge yards, but after a while, the houses thinned out, and the road turned from being paved to dirt. The Rubicon handled beautifully around the sharp turns and uneven dirt, and I couldn't keep the grin off my face. I was only going 45, but on the winding back roads, that felt more like 85, especially on an unfamiliar road. With each turn, Ibsith would squeak or giggle, while Amrila would whoop or cheer. Once we had had our fun, and had been driving for about an hour, I pulled off the back roads and over to the side of the road, while I looked up where we were on my phone. Then I plotted a route back home on the GPS and headed back to Westhurst.
That was amazing.
Amrila purred as AC/DC started to play over the speakers.
It was exciting.
Ibsith agreed from the back seat. Later today or tomorrow, we'll have to go for a driving lesson so you can try it out, I said as I looked at the blue-skinned woman through the rearview mirror.
Oh, I do not think I will try to drive those roads just yet.
My elven wife giggled. Nah, I grinned back at her. We'll find you something more tame. Soon, we got back to the house, and the women kicked off their shoes as we came through the front door. Then the ladies settled in to watch their favorite show, which they'd started to leave the subtitles on for, to help them with learning to read in English. Meanwhile, I decided to take advantage of the beautiful day and change the light on the back porch. The motion sensor was starting to get old, so I had gotten a replacement about a week ago, but hadn't gotten around to changing it yet. I went into the back room where the water heater was and opened up the breaker panel to cut the power to the porch light. Then I went into the backyard, out to Grandpa's old shed, and got out the stepladder and some tools. I hauled it all back to the porch and took the new light out of its box and read through the instructions. I was just stepping onto the ladder when I heard a knocking sound, and then David Miller's voice coming from my side yard.
"Eddie?"
Miller's voice came over the fence.
"It's not locked, David," I called back. "Come on back. Sorry, I've got my hands full."
A moment later, David opened the gates on the side yard and came around to the backyard.
"Hey, man,"
the middle-aged man said as he rubbed the back of his neck.
"I saw you talking to Brock a little while ago and figured I should come around and apologize."
"What for?" I asked, and I started to unscrew the mount that held the old light to the outer wall of the trailer. "For hearing another offer on your house? Fuck, man, of course you did. I certainly would have if I were you."
"You're not mad?"
David asked as he looked up at me from the porch.
"Hell no,"
I replied, and the mount came away from the wall as I looked over the wires connected to the back of the light. "But would you mind handing me those snips?" David looked down at the small toolbox and pulled out some wire cutters, which he then handed to me.
"Well, I'm glad you're not mad at me,"
the sandy-haired man said as he put his hands in his pockets.
"Jesse and I both like you guys better than Brock, but I'd kind of be a dumbass not to at least hear him out."
"That's fair," I nodded, and I removed the wires from the back of the old light. "Would you mind handing me up the new light?" David grabbed the new porch light and took the old one as I handed it down to him. "But what would you say to $275,000? I asked casually as I started to wire up the new light.
"What? Really?"
David sputtered as he set down the old light.
"Yeah, really," I replied. "But I'll say right now that I'm not going to keep upping my offer if Brock wants to get competitive about it.
I'd also say that, while I'm not sure how liquid Brock is, I can get you the money right away, and I'll still cover the closing costs."
"That's quite an offer,"
David said in an awed tone as he watched me screw the new mount onto the side of the old trailer. "You don't have to give me an answer right this minute," I said as I climbed down the stepladder and started to clean up the tools in the old light. "I know you'll want to talk it over with Jesse first."
"I appreciate that,"
the middle-aged man nodded.
"But if you don't mind me asking, aren't you worried about having to live next to Brock after you outbid him for the house?"
"Not really,"
I laughed, and then I put a hand on the other man's shoulder. "Brock's a bully, and if you're not willing to be pushed around, the bully doesn't have any power." David looked at me and nodded silently, and he seemed impressed with what I'd said. But what Miller and Stanton didn't know was that I wasn't afraid of Brock, because I'd killed beasts far more powerful and scary than some thick-necked manager of a small-time security company could ever be. Sure, I couldn't just go off and shoot Brock, but I also knew there was nothing the burly man could throw at me that would be more frightening than the scream of the pitworm, or a 10-foot-tall spider that erupted into a swarm of 2-foot-tall spiders after it was dead. Brock was small-time, and I was way out of his league now.
"I'll think about your offer and talk it over with Jessie,"
David said.
"She's actually found a place in Elyria she likes on one of those real estate apps."
"Well," I smiled, "that's all the more reason to consider my offer. That way you'll have the money as soon as you and Jesse spot your dream house." Miller and I said goodbye, and I put my tools away before heading into the house to turn the power back onto the spotlight. As I came out of the small back room, Ibsith came down the hall, dressed in another of her short, flowery dresses. I was going to be sad to see fall come around and my elven wife put away her summer clothes, but then again, I could always buy her cute stockings, sweaters, and thigh-high socks to help keep her warm.
"There you are, my love,"
the blue-skinned woman smiled. "Were you looking for me?" I asked with a playful raised eyebrow.
"Yes,"
the white-haired woman giggled as she came up to me.
"Do you remember how I told you I have been helping Mrs. Tynor while her husband recovers from an injury?"
"Yeah," I nodded, suddenly a little more serious. "Injured how? Is he okay?"
"I believe so,"
Ibsith replied.
"He is old and hurt his back. Mrs. Tynor has a hard time trying to keep him from doing things around the house while he gets better. I think she said he is, untired.
"You mean retired," I said after a pause while I tried to figure out what my wife meant.
"Yes,"
Ibsith nodded.
Retired. He used to be a constable, I believe. But the poor man will not stop getting up and making his back worse. So I was wondering if you could help them by fixing a light in their living room. It doesn't work right, and Mr. Tynor keeps fiddling with it.
Oh, sure. I smiled and nodded. That seems like a very neighborly thing to do.
Oh, thank you, Eddie.
The small woman threw her arms around me and squeezed me tightly. It didn't take a whole lot to make either of my wives happy, and a light fixture on the Fritz wouldn't take long to fix. I got my tools, some work gloves, and the stepladder back out and followed Ipsith over to the house almost directly across the cul-de-sac from us. It was a nice, well-kept place, with a brick facade and an open carport instead of a garage. The elven woman went up to the front porch and rang the doorbell, and I stood next to her and waited. After a moment, the door opened, and there was a very small, skinny woman in her mid-70s. Mrs. Tynor still had very long, white hair that hinted she might have been a hippie in her heyday, and the long, flowy dress she wore seemed to confirm the notion. But that did sort of explain why the older woman was keen on being friends with a young woman with pointed ears and blue-toned skin. Mrs. Tynor had probably seen even stranger things in her time.
"Ipsith?"
the older woman said as she warmly hugged my wife.
"And this must be Eddie. Oh, you are even more handsome than your wife said."
"It's nice to meet you, ma'am." I couldn't help but smile at the compliment.
"Eddie has come over to fix your light for you,"
Ipsith added.
"That way your husband will not have to worry about it while he recovers."
"Oh."
Mrs. Tynor huffed as she made a long-suffering expression.
"Ooh, Bert is not going to like that. You'll have your work cut out for you."
"I don't want to intrude," I said as I shook my head. "I wouldn't dream of stepping on another man's toes."
"Not at all,"
the older woman chuckled.
"Bert's a good man and a tomcat in the sack, but he's a stubborn old fool."
"Oh, God," I chuckled and was a little taken aback. "That's not how he hurt his back, is it?" Mrs. Tynor gave a sly wink, but didn't respond. And then she led Ipsith and I into the living room, where a barrel-chested man in his late 70s was laid up on the couch, with his feet and head propped up. Mr. Tynor still had a full head of closely cropped, iron-gray hair, and was sporting a two-day beard. His gray sweats and clean white t-shirt were somehow very neat and orderly for loungewear, and his white socks looked as if they were fresh from a new pack.
"Bert, honey,"
Mrs. Tynor said in a silky voice as we came into the room.
"Ipsith and her husband came over to visit."
"Ipsith?"
Bert Tynor gave my wife a friendly nod as a greeting, but then the old guy looked over at me and took in the stepladder and tools I was holding.
"Mr. Ipsith?"
The older man's voice was cool and gravelly as he greeted me. "Aye, Mr. Tynor." I smiled apologetically. "I'm Eddie Hill. It's nice to meet you. Ipsith told me you had a light that's not working. Since I've experience with electrical work, I thought I'd offer my help."
"Hmm."
Bert grunted and gave no indication of whether or not the help was wanted or welcomed.
"Hey, Ipsith, honey,"
Mrs. Tynor said into the awkward pause.
"Come see my new painting. It's almost done."
My wife squeezed my shoulder and turned to follow the older hippie woman deeper into the house, which left me with Mr. Tynor, who didn't seem very pleased I was there. "So," I said, since I didn't want to just stand there and stare at the old guy who was clearly stuck on the couch and mad about it. "Which light isn't working?" There were several round, recessed lights in the ceiling of the spacious living room. The decor was an odd mix of mid-century antiques, tchotchkes from around the U.S., family pictures, and what I assumed were Mrs. Tynor's paintings. The paintings were mostly landscapes, old barns and rolling hills that looked like they were from around Ohio, but they weren't bad.
"It's the one above the chair over in the corner,"
Bert grumbled in a resigned tone.
"I don't know why Judy called in reinforcements, though. I told her I would fix it."
It was Ipsith who asked me to come over. I said as I went over to the chair, set down my tools and looked up at the light. But they might have been in it together.
"Probably,"
Tynor huffed.
"But I won't say no if you want to fix it. Otherwise, we'd both just be in Dutch with our wives."
"I appreciate it," I snorted. "Where's the switch?"
"Over by the doorway to the hall,"
Bert replied, and he lifted up a worn-looking detective novel from where it had fallen next to him on the couch. I guess the old guy'd fallen asleep reading just before we'd come in. I went over to the switch Bert had pointed to and tried it a few times. The light would come on about half the time, flicker, and then go out again. I was guessing there was a short somewhere, which could potentially be dangerous, especially if it was somewhere where it could start a fire. I really hoped the short was close to the fixture so I wouldn't have to go hunting it down. "Looks like a short," I commented out loud.
"Yep,"
Tino replied without looking up from his book. "Where's the fuse box?" I asked as I thought through all the most likely places for the short to be.
"Judy!"
Bert shouted from the couch while still looking down at his novel.
"What?"
Mrs. Tynor's voice shouted back from somewhere down the hall next to me.
"Would you kill the power to the light so the boy doesn't electrocute himself?"
The old man called out.
"Which one is it?"
Judy Tynor called in reply.
"Oh, for the love of..."
Bert muttered, but then continued in a well-measured tone.
"It's the one marked LR Lights, baby."
"Okay,"
Mrs. Tynor shouted down the hall after a short pause.
"It should be off now."
I flipped the switch to check that the breaker was off and none of the recessed lights came on. So I flipped the switch back to off and got to work. I got up on the stepladder and removed the covering, and then I gently pulled out the fixture to look it over. Bert was back to reading his book, so I resigned myself to work in silence and not bug the old guy.
"How long have you two kids been together?"
the gray-haired man suddenly asked from the couch. I glanced around from examining the light fixture and saw Bert still hadn't looked up from his book. "Not long, honestly," I replied as I looked over the wire connection. "But I already know I want to spend the rest of my life with her."
"If she were any other woman, I would tell you that you're an idiot,"
the old guy chuckled.
"But Ipsith seems like a one in a million, just like my Judy. Every once in a while, you just know, right out the gate."
"Are you a romantic, Mr. Tynor?" I grinned as I looked up from my work.
"Nope,"
the gray-haired man said as he turned the page of his novel.
40 years on the force knocked any romantic ideas I had out of me by the time I was 30. But with a woman like Judy, you'd have to be a real dumb fucker not to see it."
"I think I know what you mean," I nodded.
"Did you find the problem?"
The old guy looked up from his book with a raised eyebrow. "It looks like someone didn't tighten these connections enough when they were put in. One of the wires slowly worked itself out over time. It's an easy fix."
"Huh,"
Bert grumbled again.
"Well, maybe next you'd like to look at the central air conditioning unit. Damn thing blows lukewarm air."
"I can try," I snorted as I made sure the wire was back in place and tightened up the connection. "But heating and cooling is kinda out of my wheelhouse."
"Oh, that's fine, Eddie," Bert said. "I was kidding. Old place is just slowly falling apart. Hell, if it weren't for the mortgage, I'd sell this place and take Judy somewhere warmer. Let her paint beaches instead of snow-covered barns."
As I put the light switch back in place, a funny thought occurred to me. I pictured myself standing in the middle of the cul-de-sac, playing with a mess of blue and red-skinned kids, with my many wives lounging in every yard, each with their own house. I nearly dismissed it with a chuckle to myself, but then I thought about it. Why not? Why not be king of the cul-de-sac? All it would take is a bunch of gold, and I knew exactly where to get more.